Iran launches missiles and drones in an attack on Israel.
The armed forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran carried out a series of military strikes on Israeli military objectives.
Is this the beginning of a larger conflict?
Did Iran want to damage Israel in one way or another? Absolutely. Did they want to strike Israel at the maximum that they could? It turns out, as of right now, that was probably not the case.
And later, the latest from Ukraine and the Sudanese civil war. Plus, it's been 10 years since the abduction of the Chibok girls in Nigeria. Today is Monday, April 15th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. On Sunday evening, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reconvened the war cabinet in Tel Aviv after Iran, in an unprecedented overnight attack, fired a barrage of long-range weapons toward Israel. Yoav Gallant is the Israeli defense minister.
Israel yada emesh.
Last night, Israel experienced one of the most dramatic nights we've ever experienced. Hundreds of missiles of various types were fired at the state of Israel, including over 100 ballistic missiles fired from Iran, each of them with hundreds of kilograms of explosives.
For its part, Iran said the attack was legitimate self-defense. Saeed Aravani is the Iranian ambassador to the United Nations.
The armed forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran carried out a series of military strikes on Israeli military objectives with dozens of missiles and drones. Iran's operation was entirely in the exercise of Iran's inherent right to self-defense as outlined in Article 51 of the Charter of the United Nations and recognized by international law. This concluded action was necessary and proportionate. It was precise and only targeted military objectives and carried out carefully to minimize the potential for escalation and prevent civilian harm.
The threat of open warfare erupting between Israel and Iran and dragging in the United States has put the region on edge, triggering calls for restraint from global powers and Arab nations to avoid further escalation. G7 leaders held a video meeting Sunday to discuss the situation. U.S. President Joe Biden has pledged a coordinated G7 diplomatic response to the drone and missile attack, which he condemned. Iran launched the attack in retaliation for an airstrike on its consulate in Syria on April 1st that killed top Revolutionary Guard commanders suspected of having been carried out by Israel. For a closer look at what happened, I'm joined by VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Selden at the Pentagon.
Well, on Saturday, Iran, after signaling it was going to retaliate and try to exact some revenge, launched more than 100 ballistic missiles, 30 cruise missiles, and more than 150 suicide drones, most of them from Iranian territory, in waves toward Israel. And that's according to senior U.S. officials. Now, a coalition of Israeli, U.S., Jordanian, and Saudi defense forces, both with planes in the air, ships in the sea, and in installations on the ground, anti-missile defense systems on the ground, took out what, according to Israel, was about 99% of the incoming attack. There were a few impacts, a few that managed to hit inside Israeli territory. There was reportedly some minor damage to one Israeli base. There is one girl in Israel who suffered injuries and is being treated for those injuries as a result of the attack. But largely, this defense web that was put up to thwart the Iranian attack is being hailed as very successful. The U.S. is portraying this as a significant failure for Iran because it failed to do any real damage. But there is still concern about what happens next and whether or not Israel will now take steps to retaliate against Iran.
Now, one of the things we're hearing is that the Iranian authorities gave the U.S. and Israel advance notice that these attacks were coming. Is that true? If it is true, does that take away some of the shine from this technological achievement of being able to knock all those missiles and drones out of the sky?
Well, Iranian officials have said that they gave the U.S. warning. The U.S. says it did not. Some U.S. allies, including Turkey, Turkish officials, Jordanian officials, I believe Iraqi officials, said that Iran did give them notice. So it's possible that was passed along to the U.S. It doesn't necessarily take the shine off what the U.S. and Israel and their allies, Jordan and Saudi Arabia in particular, were able to accomplish. At the same time, though, what officials and analysts will tell you is that just because it was successful this time doesn't mean it will be similarly successful if Iran or some other adversary would try something like this in the future, because that type of success is not guaranteed.
Now, Jeff, you're at the Pentagon. What are you hearing there? Any indication of what's coming next?
Well, we're going to be hearing from Pentagon officials later in the day, but we've already heard from some senior officials and from the White House. And the concern is that this does not escalate into a wider conflict. Already you have Iran, for the first time ever, launching a direct strike against Israel. And then you have what most would say, or you could say, is an unusual coalition: the United States, Israel, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia working to defend Israel. This is something that decades ago would have been shocking at the very least. So the question is, how does this evolve? What does Israel do next is really where the focus is. The U.S. President Joe Biden has told Israel that this is a success, do not escalate. But we've heard from Israeli officials and analysts that is unlikely, that Israel will feel a need, given that this is the first time Iran has launched a direct attack, to respond in some way. And again, the U.S. has said if Israel does decide to seek any revenge or to take any additional action, Israel will be going it alone. It will not have the U.S. to back it up.
VOA's Jeff Seldon is at the Pentagon. Jeff, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting on this.
Anytime.
Despite the size of the Iranian assault on Israel, is Iran really looking to escalate the situation? My next guest believes the answer is no. I'm joined by Alex Vatanka. He's director of the Iran program at the Middle East Institute.
Look, it was very clear after the Israeli strike on the Iranian embassy compound in Damascus on April 1st that Tehran had to retaliate. At least that's what they said they had to. And the Supreme Leader of the Islamic Republic, Ali Khamenei, made that point repeatedly. So he set the stage, expectations were high, and yet analysts know for a long time now that this is not exactly a regime that takes actions that might backfire in the sense of forcing the regime into a corner. So we anticipated a retaliation from Iran, but the number of drones, missiles that were launched at Israel did surprise me. And yet, what also surprised me was how it turned out they had gone out of their way to provide early warning, essentially to the Israelis through various intermediaries about what they intended to do. So did Iran want to damage Israel in one way or another? Absolutely. Did they want to strike Israel at the maximum that they could? It turns out, as of right now, that was probably not the case.
Why do you think that might be? Why were they holding back?
The one thing that seems to be the main factor here is this fear in the Islamic Republic of forcing the United States into the conflict on the side of Israel. That is their ultimate fear. It's not so much that they fear a head-to-head with the Israelis on their own. It's that they assume, probably correctly, that U.S. will quickly come to Israel's aid. And for that reason, the Iranians had to act to save face after the attack on Damascus, but do so in a way that, you know, left space for the Israelis to climb down, for both sides to be able to essentially claim victory. And it's certainly, from Iran's point of view, hope that this is the end of it.
So do you think there's more to come?
Look, I think in the short term, it looks like there isn't going to be a major Israeli retaliation, which the Iranian side had said if that happened, then they will retaliate again. That brings us to what everyone feared, the cycle of violence that will easily get out of hand, which is exactly why the United States is doing this impossible job of trying to mediate between Israel and Iran. And that's one of the sort of most interesting aspects of everything that's happened in the last few days, the role of the United States behind the scenes, trying to shape Iranian calculations in terms of their military decisions on Israel.
And what are you hearing from inside Iran? What does the Iranian public feel about what's happening? Are they on board with this?
The Iranian regime's media operations for the last day or so would let you believe that this was a major strategic victory for Iran, that militarily they achieved everything they wanted to achieve. They struck those targets inside of Israel. That's the narrative, which I'm sure the small base that supports the regime in Iran might buy into. But this does not take away the fact that vast majority of Iranians, probably around the 90%, are against what the regime is doing in terms of its regional agenda, in terms of its ideological obsession with Israel and the enmity that has been there since 1979, since the Islamic Republic was born. The way I look at the conversation in Iranian society are here a lot more fundamental questions being expressed about why we're doing this. What is it about Israel that is such a national security interest for Iran? And why should Iran, a non-Arab country, seek to be the leader in this fight against Israel when the Arab countries of the world are pursuing mostly a very different agenda vis-a-vis the Israelis? They're either seeking diplomatic solutions to the Arab-Israeli conflict, or at least they try to stay out of it. It's only Iran, and that's the ironic part, a non-Arab country that is investing so much financial and human resources into a conflict that essentially, if you take a step back and look at it, has nothing to do in protecting Iranian national interests. It's a pure ideological agenda that the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and the Revolutionary Guards are pursuing. And at this point, they have done it for so long that they have even lost the ability to step back and say, what on earth are we doing this again for?
And we'll leave it there for today. Alex Vatanga, he's director of the Iran program at the Middle East Institute. Sir, thanks for your analysis today.
Thanks very much. Great talking to you.
And now, to find out what it was like, we go inside Israel. Linda Gradstein is our Jerusalem correspondent.
Well, you know, at about 11 o'clock on Saturday night, they started saying that the missiles were on their way and they would take several hours to arrive. So it was kind of this weird feeling because you're like, OK, these missiles are on their way. What's going to happen? I went to sleep around midnight and I was woken up at about 1:45 in the morning by the booms of the Iron Dome shooting down the missiles. And then right after the booms, I heard the siren, which means that you have to go into your safe room. Every Israeli apartment, the newer apartments actually are built with safe rooms. And so we stayed in the safe room for about 10 minutes, which is what you're supposed to, and then went back to sleep. Now in Tel Aviv and parts of Israel, there were no sirens at all. Most of the missiles landed or were aimed at Jerusalem and further south. And there's actually some dramatic footage online that you can see on Facebook of the Iron Dome shooting missiles down over the Dome of the Rock Mosque in the old city of Jerusalem.
Now, this attack wasn't exactly a surprise. The Iranians had said they'd be retaliating for what happened in Damascus for a while now. Are people in Israel angry? Are they demanding that Israel strike back yet again?
Well, they're sort of, you know, people are split just the way the government split in a way, with some people saying that you know, Israel got a lot of support from the international community, and apparently even, you know, the U.S. and Jordan actually shot down some of the missiles and drones, and Israel got a lot of praise, you know, and it felt like the world was, you know, supporting Israel after, you know, weeks of a lot of very harsh criticism from the international community over the growing humanitarian crisis in Gaza, which we've talked about many times. So I think, you know, Israelis like the feeling of not being in the international doghouse. And the sense that I got from talking to people and you know, analysts and stuff is that, you know, this was a sort of a tit for tat thing. The sense that I get is that the public is not calling for a very harsh response to this attack.
So for the most part, Israelis would be okay if it ended here.
Yeah, I think so. That's really the feeling. I mean, you know, there are some people that are saying that if Israel doesn't respond, it will have lost its deterrent power. And then other people say, well, you know, Israel's been fighting in Gaza for 6 months without being able to wipe out Hamas, so it's already lost its deterrent power.
And we'll leave it there for today. VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for your reporting. Thanks for your analysis.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. 1 week after drone strikes hit a reactor building at the Russian-held Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant in southern Ukraine, the UN nuclear watchdog welcomed the shift to a cold shutdown of all 6 reactor units completed on Saturday. Still, though, the International Atomic Energy Director General Rafael Grossi said in a statement that security at the plant remains extremely fragile. VOA's Lori London gets an update from Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
There are obviously have been a lot of concerns over the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant that was hit about a week ago. Sounds like there are some updates from the International Atomic Energy Agency director.
Yeah, so following this tough week when we've heard that the Atomic Energy Agency confirmed that the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant was under attack and that there were explosions heard, and a representative of the Atomic Energy Agency on the ground confirmed that actually the attack was happening, reportedly was the use of drone, and at this point we do not have confirmation of whose drones was that, because Ukraine accuses Russia and Russia accuses Ukraine. But the latest is Rafael Grossi. He confirmed that all 6 reactor units of the Ukrainian Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant was shut down to cold. So basically what does it mean? That all reactors are now operating just to make sure that the station is active, but we do not have this real, you know, operation of the plant of such capacity. And basically what Rafael Grossi is saying, that this definitely increases the safety of the plant in the circumstances that we have right now. Basically, in case of any possible incident, the effect will be less dangerous and less risky than it could be when at least one reactor is working in full. So cold shutdown is that was International Atomic Energy Agency supporting, and it was made in order to increase the safety. But in general, Rafael Grossi highlighted that the safety situation is very bad at the plant and that the risk remains very high. The Russian forces are remaining at the plant. And from what Rafael Grossi reported recently, the situation seems quite dangerous still.
Lori London is the host of Flashpoint Ukraine here on The Voice of America. She was speaking with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. It's been a year since war broke out in Sudan, and there appears to be no end in sight. VOA spoke via video to a volunteer at one of the last functioning hospitals in Omdurman. Henry Wilkins reports.
From day one of Sudan's war a year ago, fighting between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces has ravaged Sudan's twin cities of Khartoum, its capital, and Omdurman, its largest. Millions have fled the metropolitan area because of the fighting. Some have stayed, however, either because they don't have the means to leave, or in a few cases, because they chose to stay and help. Momen Ahmed Abbas volunteers at one of Omdurman's last functional hospitals and refuses to flee the city. Speaking to VOA via video call, Abbas says he cannot abandon his patients, especially when they rely on his support. He stays to ensure they have access to essentials like food, shelter and medical care. His leaving, he says, would only exacerbate the situation for those in need. He says the situation is desperate at the hospital, which lacks medical supplies and security, and is vulnerable to frequent airstrikes and fighting. Humanitarian groups and international journalists have found entry into Khartoum and many other parts of Sudan all but impossible. And as a result, the world's awareness of the country's troubles has diminished. Commentators and diplomats often refer to Sudan's conflict as the world's forgotten war, despite as many as 16,000 people estimated to have died because of the conflict and 8.6 million forcibly displaced. A recent US intelligence report says the longer the war drags on, the more likely Sudan will become a breeding ground for terrorists. Leaders of both warring sides are wildly unpopular among most Sudanese. Neither has ever been democratically elected. Yet Sudanese civilians are the ones bearing the brunt of the ongoing fighting. Abbas says Sudan needs external help and intervention. Yet, after 1 year of fighting in Sudan, it seems clear that no substantial help is on its way. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
10 years ago, hundreds of schoolgirls were abducted in northern Nigeria by the Islamist terror group Boko Haram. Many escaped or gained freedom through negotiations, but the fate of 82 girls is still uncertain, even after a decade. The rallying cry, "Bring back our girls," dominated global headlines after the 2014 abduction, but in the decades since, mass abductions have become frequent and activists have grown weary. Timothy Obezu reports from Abuja.
This public park was once a symbol of hope and resilience, but now it holds memories of a struggle to save 82 schoolgirls still in captivity from the 276 kidnapped by Boko Haram on April 14, 2014 from Chibok Secondary School. One of them is Nkeki Mutah's niece.
Every day, in the morning, in the afternoon, we feel pain about this because of the absence of this, our niece. We heard that some were dead, and that is one of the things that we are advocating. If government can be kind enough to tell us or to release all the names of those that are dead so that we can forget about it.
Days following the kidnappings, activists coalesced and started the Bring Back Our Girls or BBOG movement, demanding their rescue. Back then, the group met daily and their campaign sparked global outrage. But not anymore. Alan Manasseh is the spokesperson of the Chibok community and a member of the BBOG movement.
There is fatigue in the struggle. When the Bring Back Our Girls started and it was gaining traction globally, there are a lot of responses from even foreign governments ready to support Nigeria.
Nigerian authorities say they have not forgotten those in captivity. General Christopher Musa is Nigeria's defense chief.
If it was we're using the conventional method of fighting, we would have entered all the communities and flattened everything to start all over. But we can't do that because we know there are no state actors holding other people against their will. So we have to be very deliberate. There are instances where we've gone for attack because civilians were there, we call off the strike.
Families and BBOG activists disagree. They say authorities have not shown the political will to address the problem. On Sunday, they remembered the girls on the 10th year anniversary of their abduction.
Unfortunately, the Chibok girls' abduction was only the beginning of countless abductions that have led to a thriving abduction industry in our nation. Since the government has refused to bring the perpetrators of the abduction of our Chibok girls to book.
Until the girls are freed, many will be waiting for some sense of closure. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Carrick.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.